From WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen, inviting you all to participate in our program. Actually, the program is normally an interactive live program on Thursday mornings. This week, it is not a live program on Thursday because we are recording in advance on Wednesday evening. This is an event that we have been publicizing for some time. It's associated with the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception that is being held on Wednesday evening at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington with a very special guest, Gene Cochran. And Gene was on the air with us a number of weeks ago as we were conducting our spring fun drive at WEKU. And we have invited her to be with us in person. We have about 50 or 60 people in the room at the Griffin Gate, and we're going to invite them to be a part of our conversation as well during this week's program. Gene Cochran, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and it's nice to be on the radio again.
What do you think about being on the radio in the daylight with the
sun? Yeah, it's a little different. I watched the sun come up so many days, I can't count for 30 years.
Gene, as a morning edition newscaster, you were there at NPR from very, very early in NPR's history. Let's talk a little bit about your involvement at NPR.
Sure.
How that all came about. How did you end up? First of all, your early interest in broadcasting, what caused you to even consider working in radio?
I was about 22 years old, and I knew I wanted to get into communications. This was the era of Mary Tyler Moore. I wanted to do that. I wanted to work in broadcasting somehow, some way. And from there, I sort of decided news would be a contribution to society. Here I am, about 22 years old. Okay, news, now what? Television, print, or radio? Television gets in the way of sources. Television has too many, you know, microphones, I mean, cameramen, lightmen, at least at that time, even a field producer maybe. That gets in the way of a story. Print, you just a pad and pencil. It's pretty pure, but you have to spell people's names right and get their middle initials. This was too much level of detail for me at that time. I thought radio was just right because you could break in with a breaking news story without getting, you know, television was too cumbersome to break into a soap opera. It took a while. So I thought the immediacy of radio, I did not want looks to be a factor in my career. So I ruled out television. You age better on radio, it's fine. So then NPR, of course, at this time, mid-70s, was coming into its own, and it was the place to be. And I went to American University, which has WAMU-FM, a 50,000-watt public radio station. And by the time I came back from 5 years in Vermont and New Hampshire, working in commercial radio there, public radio hadn't grown that much to be there. I had friends at WAMU. Morning edition had just begun. And so it was being in the right place at the right time, knowing people, having some experience, and I filled in the summer of May of 81 on Morning Edition, and by the fall they'd hired me as an associate producer on the show and a fill-in newscaster.
Did you study journalism in school?
Oh, I did, at American University, broadcast journalism.
Now, I would imagine...
That's where I made all those decisions.
Imagine that the field has changed, though. I mean, what you were taught... Let's talk about what you were taught in journalism, what you learned in journalism, and elements of that have really maybe turned on their ear, as it were, and then really have become very different in these 30 years.
Oh, that's a PhD thesis, but I think the fundamentals are the same: writing, good delivery, good news, journalistic tenets of journalism. Polices itself. There's no place where I go to get certified as a journalist and have that to hang on my wall. I get a degree in broadcast journalism, but oh, it's changed so much, John. I can't tell you, but I think that there are fundamentals that stay the same. A good investigative journalism, getting things from more than one source, making sure it's right, not rushing to air with bad information just because it's awfully tempting to. Things like that, I think, remain the same, but yeah, with the advent of social media and people picking up their phone to get the news each morning, it's changed incredibly.
You talk about not rushing to air with stories which is really very counter to much of what commercial media and many forms of journalistic media pursue today. But that was really at the heart of NPR, was always a sense of going in depth, taking time to get it right rather than rushing to get it on the air. How would, and you were there pretty much at the beginning, how did that form? Was that the goal of the people who formed NPR in those early days?
Well, it was a conscious decision along the way, very early, to not worry so much about being first with information, but being concerned about getting it right. I think NPR's mission is simply to be, to inform and enlighten with information our listeners and in any way we can, be it arts, news, science. So that's our mission in collaboration with member stations like WEKU. But yes, definitely along the way, a decision was made early on that we're not going to try to be that. We're not going to try to be the beat the buzzer journalistic outfit. We're the more thoughtful, stand back, put things in context, look at it. Now, I work for Newscast, which is concerned with timely information, and we have a strict set of principles we go by. We must have more than one source to confirmation, attribution, you know, our reporters, we listen to our reporters, those of us who are news anchors, who say, no, no, don't go with that yet. Let me check it out, that kind of thing.
And your role as a newscaster is not that of a reporter. You did not actually go out to events and stand there with a microphone and interview people and record sound of things happening. But you were in a position of collecting and organizing material to share within a five-minute newscast. Let's talk a little bit about that process. How did you make those decisions? And I know you're still doing that on call, even in the retirement that you have taken. But in when you're in that newsroom, how do you decide what you're going to do at a minute past the top of the hour?
I'm a processor of news. It's a conduit. I read, I write, I deliver. I wash, rinse, repeat, and I do it seven times in the morning, 5 days a week. It's quite a grind. But the news changes, and I've internalized so much of that editorial judgment, it would take a while to tease it all out of me, but I'm reading the wires, I know what's important, I'm looking forward, it's a morning, so I'm looking forward, I'm going to tell you what happened late yesterday, but I'm looking forward to what's happening in the day. If there's anything that happened overnight, any bombs going off in the foreign world or whatever, determining what is news isn't really that hard. There's not a big mystery about it. At least I don't think so. And then you're mixing it up with the sound that my producer's given me, spots, actualities, that kind of thing. And it's a constant, you're really focused for that time once those newscasts start. Now I'm 5:30, 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, 11:30. All those news, and the news changes after, by 9:30, things are different. The domestic world is up and at 'em, and Congress is holding hearings, and things are happening around the country as opposed to the foreign world. So there's kind of that natural shift from foreign to domestic. But I hope I've answered your question here. All I can say is it's exciting.
Well, does the newscaster actually make that decision?
Oh, yes.
How, and the order in which the stories are going to be fed?
Yes, I have full autonomy.
And you're choosing a hierarchy of what is, you know, how do you choose what is the lead story, the first thing out of your mouth at the beginning, you know, from NPR News, I'm Gene Cochran, and then you tell us something. How do you decide what that's going to be?
Well, I need a PowerPoint here with a grid to show you that it's a matter of timing, what's happening, or just wait, but this is more important. Even though something else is newer, this is more important. So there's a constant juggling of these factors, timing, importance. Is it ongoing? Does this story have legs? It may have been big yesterday, but it's poof now. But no, there's a second day story with that. All these things are coming into play that you're, and it's always different. So that's why I can't give you a pat answer. It's I always thought I do the same. I might as well be on an assembly line doing the same thing every day, but the substance, the content is always different. And that's what created the challenge, causes the challenge.
What about the balance between American, for instance, federal government activities versus international news, NPR, I would say certainly versus other American radio and other broadcast networks certainly focuses more on news that's happening elsewhere beyond our borders.
Yes, thank you for noticing that. I think that there is a dearth of foreign reporting on the broadcast and cable news outlets, and I think NPR does see as part of its mission to make sure that these far-flung corners of the world, that we're shedding light on them and that people are learning about them. We need to know about what's happening in our world. And you're going to hear more foreign reporting and interviews and context on NPR probably than you will just about any other outlet, except maybe The Economist.
in so many other media, it's very obvious that the old saw that many of us have heard, if it bleeds, it leads, major accidents, death, destruction, war, crime. That is obviously
Describe my day.
But that's obviously not as important to NPR.
Man's inhumanity to man. Mm. If it bleeds, it leads is an old thing that we used to say about, and we would hang, those of us in network would hang that on local news operations, TV in particular. But that's not certainly the principle, a principle we go by. I will say if a bomb goes off and there's 127 people killed, it may have a little more weight than if there was five people killed. Now that sounds callous, but these are the things that you're weighing everything, and I don't know how to get out of that.
Well, we're what we'll do is we'll take a break.
All right.
our guest is Gene Cochran. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. And this is a special program recorded on Wednesday evening, May 7th, at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington. And we have an audience in place here on this Wednesday evening. And when we come back, we're going to ask our audience to consider coming forward with any questions or comments that you may have, or how, and your stories about how NPR has affected your life on Eastern Standard. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. This week, our special guest is Gene Cochran. At one point, we were identifying Gene as a retired newscaster from NPR, but she actually still works for NPR at times. You will, perhaps even since her retirement in December of last year, you may have heard Gene on the air doing news. And actually, Gene, before we talk to some of our members in the audience at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington, talk about how that happens. You retired in December. NPR offered a retirement buyout to a number of employees, and you were among how many people?
About 90 took it. They offered it to the staff. I mean, there were certain qualifications, having been there a certain length of time, whatever. But because NPR has been running a deficit for a few years, and they were under orders from the board to erase that deficit, and so part of it instead of laying people off, they took the humane route and offered buyouts, and so about 90 people.
And that was totally voluntary.
Totally voluntary.
How about the decision process that you went through in deciding to take that retirement?
I went through an emotional roller coaster. I cried. Because just leaving the community of my news colleagues and the daily, I love newscasting on Morning Edition, but I've also done it a long time, and those hours are the downside. And so sanity prevailed, and I accepted the buyout, but it comes with 30 days that they can call us back and use us. So I call myself a bench player. I may get a call to come in and fill in for somebody. So that's fun. I'm really glad I can do that.
Eastern Standard is an interactive program, and on Thursday mornings when we are live, we invite people to call in, send us emails, follow us, and send us messages on Twitter, even post on Facebook. We have a live audience at the Griffin Gate Marriott, and we have our first, let's call her, not a caller of the evening, but we have a guest ready to ask a question. Peggy, go right ahead.
Thank you. Since you had such a high-profile job, really, how are you doing with retirement now?
I'm doing fine. I realize, thank you for acknowledging that there's a bit of a profile to having done newscasts on Morning Edition for so long, and so I'm hoping to kind of cash in on that in a way, you know, keep that go. Is that bad? Is that sad to say? But I want to do some voiceover narration. I want to maybe teach at my alma mater, American University. I want to help public radio stations that would like to have me help them in a consulting way on news writing and delivery. And there's one other thing. Oh, public speaking. So if there's a, you know, if people want to hear from Gene Cochran, I'm happy to accommodate. And I think retirement's great. I mean, for a while I felt a little bit like in gravity, you know, you're just in space and you're out there. Because I went from such a tough, tightly prescribed day, you know, get in there at 3 a.m., newscast, boom, 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 living by the clock, going to bed at 6 in the evening, and then getting, and now there's nothing, I'm in free fall, but I'm taking steps slowly, one by one, and I'm doing things, and I've been very busy, and I'm really enjoying redefining myself and finding new things to do, new challenges. I love it.
One of the great things about our era is that people are retiring at an age in which they can still do many other things. There are a lot of people, probably others in this room, visiting with us this evening who may be retired and still very actively involved in things that they are
that they love.
And is that how you see it? You can now do what
so.
You love. You no longer have obligations as
yes.
such.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This is Eastern Standard. We are live at the Griffin Gate Marriott Hotel on Wednesday evening, May 7th, recording our program with Gene Cochran, retired Morning Edition newscaster, retired from the regular position of being there at 3 o'clock in the morning and delivering news starting at 5 o'clock. But she's our guest this week. And we have members of the audience, WEKU Day sponsors, who are here to ask questions. And with us here, this is Martha with a question. Good thing for name tags. I'm glad for those.
I've been a NPR news listener for many, many, many years and very regular for Morning Edition. What I'm curious about is when the Morning Edition hosts are actually doing interviews with people, mm-hmm. foreign correspondents or whatever, how much is that live and how much is that pre-recorded? Because, I mean, they're always saying, well, we got to go now and wrap it up really quickly. But I was just sort of curious how that works and fits into a newscast.
That's your key sign that it's live when they say, okay, thank you very much. got to go. But they do pre-tape in the middle of the night, especially foreign things. The host will come in at Stevens Keep. I know Bob Edwards used to come in at 2 in the morning, and some of that time, not only was he jumping into the news stream and reading about what was getting up to speed on the news, but they would call him in for interviews that then someone would go edit that interview and turn it around and get it on the show just a couple hours later. But that would be foreign because we're not really talking to people at 2 in the morning in this country. But so there's no set formula at all. It really, the news dictates whether it's the afternoons. I mean, they do interviews. The show goes into rollovers, and the hosts are there to update if need be, but they're using that morning time to do interviews that then will be edited, and then they won't be live, right? They'll go on the show. Arts editors interviews or news interviews that will then air the next day.
Morning Edition actually continues until noon Eastern time.
Right.
Folks on the West Coast can then have it until 9 o'clock.
Right. Call that rollovers.
And if there's major breaking news, what happens in that situation?
major, major breaking news. For instance, your September 11th attack, the show just went into full. They stopped newscasts after 9:30 or 10 and went into full mode where we're just in the studio now and we're talking about this story and we're getting whoever we can to report for us. But other than that, if there's a change, a correction, or if there's something broken, the president said something, they'll jump into a segment and they'll manufacture something.
That's one of the side effects of the 9/11 attacks, is that there's somebody ready to go live at just about any time now.
It always was, though, before 9/11. Mm-hmm. The host always stayed, always stayed until noon, until that show went off the air. Mm-hmm. And rollovers were done.
Gene Cochran is our guest on this week's Eastern Standard, and stepping to the microphone is James. Go right ahead with your question, James.
Thank you. A longtime NPR listener. But for the last 4 years, I've spent my time in the UK listening to BBC4, okay? And my question is, how do you compare and contrast how the BBC presents news and interviews compared to NPR's way of doing it?
I don't know, because I've never really listened to the BBC straight on. We have NPR has an agreement with BBC, and we do lift reports, and we do talk to their reporters sometimes, but I've never really listened to a BBC, certainly not BBC Four, as you say. So, but you know, their style, they're good. They're very good. And I'm not sure I can compare them, though. I don't feel confident doing that.
They tend to ask a lot of really hard questions, from what I've seen.
Do they?
And they don't take sides ever. No matter who they're interviewing, they will go after them full force.
Good.
And that, to me, is a very good way to go at it.
Yes. So.
Great. Thank you.
It's the ideal. Thank you.
And so, Gene, in your role as a newscaster, you never really have been involved in doing questioning?
Interviewing.
And for instance, as newscasters, do the newscasters at NPR sometimes pick up the phone and actually call out to contact sources?
No.
Who does that? Who does that at 3:30 in the morning, getting
ready
for your 5 o'clock newscast?
There's a producer, there's an editor of copy, but there's also an editor of sound, and among them, somebody can jump into a studio and say, "Okay, we want to two-way you on the story. We want to get it now," and talk to somebody, and then cut that up and use just slices of that in the newscast. The newscasters don't do that because we're concentrating on writing. And so there are other people who will deal with the sound.
Gene Cochran is our guest on this week's Eastern Standard, and we have an audience here at the Griffin Gate Marriott, and we'll encourage you, if you have a question for Gene Cochran, to step up to the microphone. It looks like this is Jeanette.
Yes.
Jeanette, go right ahead with your question.
You said there were 90 people who took early retirement.
90-something, yeah.
Okay. And that reminds me of my concern about funding for National Public Radio as well as public TV.
Mm-hmm.
What now is the federal portion of funding? And maybe you can answer also what the proportion of the different sources of funding. I'm not clear on what
sure.
that is.
Sure. And I'm not an expert on this. The last time I looked, which was probably a while ago, 17% of our budget, NPR's budget, was government funding. Oh, just
federal,
a small amount.
Federal or state and federal?
No, federal.
Federal.
And
it actually comes through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
And comes through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the rest of what we gather is corporate underwriting. For the stations, it's listeners like you and businesses, local businesses who want to fund their stations. That's about the extent of my knowledge. And I'm not even sure about that figure, but I know if you go to NPR's website and dig around, you will find it. It's public information. It's not anything we're hiding or anything.
Well, NPR, actually, I don't think they actually take direct donations from listeners. For instance,
no.
Here at the local stations, when we conduct a fund drive and we say we need to pay for the programming, What we're doing is trying to pay about $300,000+ a year in fees that we pay to NPR, to Public Radio International, American Public Media, and that's part of NPR's, a major part of NPR's funding base are those fees paid by individual stations.
Has anybody heard of Jennifer and Ted Stanley? They were about the last people, individuals, who were ever able to give to NPR, and it stopped with them. That began way back in the 70s.
Why did it stop?
Because I'm not sure whether it was legal or what the decision was made, but it was NPR takes from foundations, from corporate underwriting, from entities, not individuals.
In a similar fashion, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Not from them specifically.
Right.
So how about WEKU? How much of this station's funding comes from the different sources?
And if I get this wrong, General Manager Roger Duvall will step up to the microphone and help out here. But, I mean, our budget is over $1 million, $1,200,000 per year. Corporate money we bring in at this point has been somewhere in the range of $100,000 a year, and that's what our man Frank Sundrum does. The listener contributions are coming in, again, as I mentioned, maybe $300,000 to $350,000 or so to pay for the programming. The funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are probably in just about that same range. We receive an annual grant called a community service grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is an entity that receives allocation from the federal government, but it is not a federal government agency as such. Those funds are then shared with individual radio and stations. TV stations, of course, receive a lot more than the radio stations. And most of what we receive from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting goes right back out the door to help pay the fees, again, for the programming from NPR and the other producers.
So viewers contribute about 30%, if I got that? 300,000 out of a million?
Actually, it's going to be a little, in that range. That's pretty much the max at this point. And again, public radio and public broadcasting in general is under pressure to diversify the funding. Very little of the money actually comes from the government, but we're increasingly dependent on the listeners, mm-hmm. and of course on businesses who choose to underwrite. So just as you hear announcements on NPR from the foundations and the businesses that underwrite, you will hear local businesses or regional businesses here in Kentucky that are supporting public radio.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking that question, and we're certainly glad to answer those for you. Of course, your questions for Gene Cochran are welcome. Our audience in attendance at the Griffin Gate Marriott on this Wednesday evening, the WEKU Day Sponsor of Reception, something that we've been promoting for a number of months. And Gene Cochran here for the duration of this week's program. Gene, you mentioned working with people such as Bob Edwards at NPR, and we had a conversation a couple of months ago about this, but let's talk about some of the people you've worked
sure.
with, some of the most interesting people you've had an opportunity to work with at NPR, because I would imagine everyone is interested in knowing more about Carl Kasell.
Absolutely, you're right. My work husband, he is what you hear on the radio. He is a sweet, gentle, intelligent man. He's a wonderful person, and he's stepping down this month, in a week or two. He stepped down from newscast a couple years ago. Time flies, three maybe. And now he's actually stepping down from Wait, Don't Tell Me. But what a career he's had. What a wonderful contribution he has made, and I am really privileged to have had him as my mentor and friend all these years. Very special. Susan Stamberg, she's my big sister. She's wonderful. Arts maven, really brings to life anything she writes about, even if it's a painting you can't see. She's such a wonderful writer, and I admire her greatly. Over the years, I've edited, because I was a swing shift on Morning Edition editor for a while there. Cokey Roberts, Linda Wertheimer, they were our Capitol Hill correspondents at the time. Jim Angle, who went on to be a Fox News reporter. I don't know what he's doing now. Ira Flatow, Scott Simon was in our Chicago bureau.
Ira Glass worked with NPR, did he?
Ira Glass worked with NPR. Oh, sure. He was a young pup at producing All Things Considered. Mm. I mean, first working on the show and working his way up to producing All Things Considered, and then the rest is history with his wonderful program. Who else? Oh, you know, Carlos Quintanilla on CNBC. He interned at NPR. I remember seeing him there. Who else?
And of course, you went through the transition from Bob Edwards to the new morning edition Renee. With Steve Inskeep and Renee. Yeah.
I mean, I miss Bob like a lot of people, but I think that and Steve and Renee do a great job. I think they wanted two hosts. And so that's what they got, because that gives the flexibility of one host being out, being a host reporter. And Steve and Renee are doing a great job, and it's a slightly different sound of the show, but I think it's weathered well, and is they're doing great.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Our special guest this week is Gene Cochran. We're due to take another short break. We are at the Griffin Gate Marriott Resort and Spa, I guess is the correct way to identify the facility, here of the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception on Wednesday evening, May the 7th. And we'll be back with another full segment of our program with Gene Cochran and our guests, and hopefully some more questions from our audience on the WEKU stations. It's Eastern Standard. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and this is a very special edition of our program, a program recorded at the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception at the Griffin Gate Marriott in Lexington. And our special guest is Gene Cochran. In December of 2013, Gene Cochran was among 90-some NPR employees who took advantage of an early retirement buyout offered to employees in order to help NPR balance their finances. And in order to make sure that they had the resources to continue serving listeners and the stations across the country and really around the world. Gene took that early retirement buyout, but she's still around. She's still doing newscasts at times as a replacement, a bench player for NPR at times. And she's visiting with us in Lexington this week on behalf of WEKU and in collaboration with Women Leading Kentucky. And we should talk a little bit about that event as well. But we have members of the audience here with questions and comments, and they're invited and welcome to step forward. And I'm sorry, your name is Daisy? Daisy has a question for Gene Cochran. Go right ahead, Daisy.
I do. I'm curious, in 30 years of reporting, what story just shook you to the core and maybe even changed your personal perspective positively and negatively?
Well, of course, the answer is the September 11th attacks. I think that's a story that shook everybody, having to report it, and it's not only the day of, but then in the aftermath and the days afterward. And my antidote, because it was so horrific, and you knew it just is changing our lives as we knew it in ways yet to unfold. I wanted to escape, and so I picked up a book, and I picked up Peter Guralnick's two-volume biography of Elvis Presley and went back to the 1950s. And it's a great book. I highly recommend it. And then that launched an eBay obsession, which I started buying. This was not the answer you were expecting. Memorabilia from the 50s of Elvis Presley. And I really got into that for a while. And now if you come to my home, you'll see I have many photographs by Alfred Wertheimer, taken in 1956 of Elvis. I met Wertheimer. I mean, I just was a fanatic for a couple of years there. So that was a reaction to a story that was kind of you know, I just completely went somewhere else for a little while. And we all, you know, cope in different ways. Another big story that changed me was my first big story. It had to be 81, maybe 82, Anwar Sadat's assassination. That was the first time I went on the air in a newscast with a news of an assassination, and that it unfolded all morning. And then when I went home, I kind of went, phew, what just happened? You know, that was huge. So, yes.
And this is Dan.
Yes.
With a question for Gene Cochran. Go right ahead, Dan.
Hi. Gene, the number of the commercial TV news stations are viewed as openly partisan to the left or the right. Personally, I view NPR's right down the middle, and a news station I trust. How do you deal with those issues? How do you avoid being labeled too liberal or too conservative, or
well,
is that even an issue?
Well, we're going to get the labels no matter what, and we feel like we're doing something right when we get complaints that we're too right, along with complaints that we're too left. Because a lot of it is how you perceive the information, where the listener is coming from, and how they process the information. But NPR, I believe, has just remained rock steady through that whole revolution of cable 24-hour news, and now, you know, fighting over who's less biased but really is. And so I think NPR has just managed to stay steady as she goes by adhering to our principles and trying to be as fair as, and to get context to a story, talk to people who know about it and can put it into some perspective rather than just going off at the handle. And we're not having a lot of talking heads to come on and rant unchallenged, I don't believe.
Thank you.
Dan, thank you for that question. Okay. And we invite others of our audience at the Griffin Gate Marriott to step forward with questions or comments for Gene Cochran. And let me toss this out there. Interested very much, always interested in stories in our program, rather than mere questions or certainly comments, but stories about how NPR, Gene Cochran, have affected your life. Putting that on you, but is this Bobby? I'm sorry.
I'm trying to
read the name tags from here. Bobby, thank you, Bobby.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Wonderful.
We in TV, we had Barbara Walters. In radio, we had Gene Cochran. All right? Yeah.
Thank you.
So, and you might get this question tomorrow at the conference, but what advice would you give to budding, sorry guys, female journalists?
Sure.
Right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby.
I know when I was coming up, I just plowed through. I think my advice is if you find a hurdle, go around it, find another way, because you can't let things stop you and you can't get caught up in litigating some perceived slight. So I would also advise adhering to basic principles, again, of whatever your profession is. But just perseverance. If you really want something, I was thrilled the day I got hired by NPR, and I was thrilled every day thereafter to be working there. I had reached where I wanted to be, and I got there by hook or by crook. I'll talk about it tomorrow, but at the Women Leading Kentucky conference. But everybody has their own path, and you kind of have to figure it out, and it's never straight and narrow, but I think women would do well to just forget they're women and think of themselves as the profession that they're pursuing, and find out everything about that profession and its tenets, and adhere to it as best you can.
Gene, that actually brings up a good point. Over the years that you spent 33 years at NPR, NPR was always pretty inclusive terms of women, minorities. First of all, how was that for you? I mean, some of us who started out in broadcasting, to be perfectly honest, we would go to work at radio stations where the folks who were there were all white men. Mm-hmm. And they were frequently sitting around smoking cigarettes, maybe even toking on a cigar in the newsroom or in the radio studios next to the equipment. But at NPR, it was never quite that way, was it?
No, it wasn't. And when I came along, Susan Stamberg, Cokie Roberts, Nina Totenberg, and Linda Wertheimer were earning their title as founding mothers of NPR. I'm not sure why, but it was just such a fledgling operation, and it was open to taking any talent that came in, and it was a bunch of young men and women who had great ideas and idealism about how the news should be done, could be done, the theater of the mind radio. So it's always been open like that, and it's always struggling to remain diverse. Yeah, NPR is just a special place. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, were there efforts to go out and recruit? Of course, a public radio, you have the most interesting sounding names, frequently, and the most interesting accents on the air.
I'm pretty white bread, Gene Cochran here, but then there's Lakshmi Singh and Corva Coleman and Sylvia Poljoli, and we have some great names. Things have been done on that. Google it. But yeah, I mean, there is an effort made to find people. I mean, looking at their qualifications over anything else, and their chops, what they know, and what they can bring to the effort at NPR is first and foremost, and always the rest falls aside.
How do you feel, Gene Cochran, about the changes in terms of social media and accessibility? Any one of us, you know, for a long time now, any one of us could pick up a video camera and shoot a video of things going on. But now we can carry that video camera in our pocket. We can send out messages that hundreds, thousands, perhaps even millions can see. Stories can go viral and perhaps even scoop NPR and the professional newscasters. I mean, what do you think about it? Is that going to change journalism and the ability of those who follow you at NPR?
It already has. Twitter is an amazing, powerful thing, and I follow news, mostly news outlets. I mean, maybe Ricky Gervais and Steve Martin, but I follow mostly news people. And people are getting their news from Twitter, and that's a little scary. And one of the tenets at NPR is we look at Twitter, we see what's going on there, but we would never, ever use Twitter or Wikipedia as a source. Because neither of them is gospel. But they certainly steer you or alert you to what's going on. And so we're not ignoring them, that's for sure.
Let's go back to our audience. Is it Rory?
Yes.
Rory has a question for Gene Cochran.
You mentioned the difficulty sometimes in pronouncing names like Sylvia Poggioli and others. Is there one story that gave you particular problems, either from the names involved or the subject matter, where you just lost it and you just really barely held it together to deliver the news?
It happens every year. It's called Nobel Award season. And they come out at 6 in the morning, and you've got this name of some prize winner in metaphysiology, and
even a science or something, you may not even know what that is. Huh?
Well, no, I mean, they're set, you know, it's medicine, I can't remember them, literature, medicine, physiology, economics, and chemistry. And so you're liable to get some names with, you know, one vowel and five consonants or something. And you just have to, there's nothing you can do except go on the air and say Shribet won the Nobel Prize. And then it'll work out later. You can't not tell the news because you don't know how to pronounce his name. And it just came out a minute ago. So that you're kind of caught between a hard place and a rock there. We all do our best with that. But yeah, you know, I tell a story that I didn't go into print because it was too detailed with the spelling and names and stuff. And now I find in radio, I've got to pronounce them. So it's the same thing, really.
Well, in related matter, Gene, I know any of us who've worked in broadcasting will have experiences, maybe perhaps with our coworkers, or practical jokes or things occurring in the background while you're trying to do a newscast, beyond content oriented. Do you have any stories, anything, experiences
this
like that?
This is NPR, John.
No one setting
NPR.
Fire to scripts in the trash can.
Yeah, right. Those are the stories. Everybody coming up had those stories about somebody doing that. No. Not on the network. We wouldn't do that.
This is Eastern Standard, and with the question is Sherry.
I have so many questions for you, Gene Cochran. Well, before the show, you mentioned something about newscasts being, what did you call it, the haiku of news?
I did, the haiku of news. I coined that. And it really is, because it's 5 minutes divided into 3 minutes and 2 minutes, at NPR anyway. And so you've got to fit in, as much information as you can around sound, be it a spot or an actuality. Actuality being somebody, a person talking, a newsmaker or somebody on a scene, as opposed to a reporter. And so make that fit. There's a post at 3 minutes. This is NPR. Pause, start again with two more minutes. And to make it all come out. And I'm constantly editing up to before going on the air or during the air and shortening things. I had a lot of fun doing seat of the pants news sometimes.
And in addition to that, is there a rule about how much sound you need to use in a newscast? Do you have to use something from Ukraine and something from the West Coast and something from the East Coast? How does that work?
Well, a principle anyway is I want to have sound in my lead story, be it a reporter, a spot, news spot reporter, or actuality, a newsmaker, the president or whomever. Helping me to tell that story, get a piece of information out. Because it's so much more interesting when it comes from, you don't want to hear me reading for 5 straight minutes. That's why we incorporate sound. It's the medium. It's using the medium. But there's no hard and fast rule about you must have 5 pieces of sound in 5 minutes of news. And it would fluctuate. I've gotten it. Sometimes it's a matter of pride. I got 7 or 8 pieces of sound in that cast. Yeah. but as long as it was, the cast went along and people understood what I was saying, that certainly is paramount and what the story was and their learning. So, yeah. We used.
We have just about time for one more question on this week's special edition of Eastern Standard from the Griffin Gate Marriott Resort and Spa, recorded on Wednesday evening, May 7th. And in the audience here is Karen. Go right ahead, Karen.
This is more of a comment than a question in response to how does NPR impact your daily life. And my husband and I, the first night we met, started talking about NPR. And it's part of our daily lives to this day. And in the morning, I drive to Richmond to work at EKU. And as I get there, I listen to NPR, Morning Edition. And then I call him, and I say, you have to listen to whatever story. A lot of it's the health reports that are on a Monday morning. And I just want to thank you for contributing that. And also, if there's any comments you can think about whether people have listened to stories or those NPR moments, where you stay in the garage or the driveway. If you have, have you ever had an NPR moment?
I have. This is years ago, and it was a weekend, or it was a Friday, and I was driving to Virginia Beach, and I'd just gotten to my brother's house there. And Robert Siegel was doing a piece on the lyrics to Louie Louie. And I had to stay in the car and hear that explanation. There was no question about it. So that was my little driveway moment where I stayed in the car. I have an Elantra, a new one, and I think this is a driveway moment thing that when I turn the car off, everything goes off except the radio. The radio doesn't go off until I open the car door. I think that's a result of driveway moments.
Well, Gene, in the last 2 minutes of our special edition of this Eastern Standard, what do you listen to now that you're no longer reporting the news in the morning?
Music. I do. I still listen to the news a lot, just because I can't let it go. But I'm listening to All Things Considered in Morning Edition. I didn't get to listen to them while I was working. All things considered, I'd be in bed by that time. And Morning Edition, I'm working and I can't hear it. I'd hear the 5 minutes before me, and sometimes I'd get a tear from StoryCorps on Friday right before my newscast and have to regain my composure before going on the air. But so I am listening to Fresh Air. I am enjoying public radio in a way I never could before. And so, yeah.
All right. Well, Gene Cochran has been our special guest for
Thank
this
you so
week's
much.
Eastern Standard, with an audience of 50 or 60 people at the Griffin Gate Marriott as the part of the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception. We're grateful, of course, to our listeners for your support of WEKU, and grateful to Gene Cochran for the work you've did for 33 years for NPR, and still you're still an ambassador for public radio.
Thanks for being with us. Thank you so much, John.
Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. Our associate producers are Andrew Moorhead, Richard Turner, and Logan Riley. Our technical director, normally, is Jonies Franklin. A reminder, the show will be available online for online listening and as a podcast that you can download. It's also repeated on Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock. You'll find an archive of every one of our Eastern Standard programs when you go to the website at weku.fm. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at WEKUEST. I always have a hard time getting that out. At WEKUEST. For Eastern Standard and WEKU, I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for being with us.